From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, seeking justice after atrocities. November 9th marks 80 years after Kristallnacht, the Nazi-led attack on thousands of synagogues, cemeteries, and Jewish-owned properties across Austria, Germany, and German-occupied Czechoslovakia, which foreshadowed the Nazi genocide against Jews.
President Roosevelt, in a statement without precedent, speaks out against the persecution of minorities in Germany. He says he could scarcely believe such things could occur. Acting on presidential instruction, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, it is indicated that he will not return to Germany soon.
For the show this week, we spoke with Ben Ferenz. He was one of the lead prosecutors in the Nuremberg trials, the court cases against Nazi leaders following World War II. Ferenz was a Jewish U.S. Army vet, born in Romania, educated at Harvard. He was 27 years old when he was chosen to be a Nuremberg prosecutor. He'd never tried a case before.
Vengeance is not our goal, nor do we seek merely a just retribution. We ask this court to affirm by international penal action man's right to live in peace and dignity, regardless of his race or creed. The case we present is a plea of humanity to law.
Ferenz's story is told in the new documentary, Prosecuting Evil, The Extraordinary World of Ben Ferenz, directed by Barry Averich. I interviewed Ferenz 3 weeks before the shooting attack at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last month that killed 11 people. Ben Ferenz, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tell us where you were born and when you came to New York.
I was born in Transylvania. You've heard about my Uncle Dracula? That's what people know about Transylvania. I was educated in the streets of New York to begin with. And from there, I couldn't get admitted to public school, the usual age, because I couldn't speak English and I was very short. However, by the time I was 8, I was educated in a public school. I went to a special high school, Townsend Harris in New York, which was for gifted boys only, of course. I went to City College, which was also free. We had no money. From there, I applied for Harvard. I was accepted. I got a scholarship for my exam on criminal law and became an outstanding student. And that was my education as far as schooling was concerned. My real education, of course, came out of life itself.
When did you join the U.S. Army?
I joined the U.S. Army as quickly as I could get in, as soon as the war broke out. I was in law school at the time, and I found that most of the services wouldn't accept me. I wanted to be a flyer, but they said my legs wouldn't reach the pedals. I was 5'2" tall, and I applied for Navigator, and they said if I was told to bomb Berlin, I'd end up in Tokyo. I had no talent in that direction. Well, I kept trying in different directions. Finally, I ended up as a private assigned to the artillery, the 115th AAA Gun Battalion. And I was allowed to finish my schooling by special permission, the request of the dean for an extension for a few months' time. And I went into the Army, and served in that capacity when we landed on the beaches of Normandy and when the war was on.
So at the end of the war, how did you become a part of a war crimes unit?
When I was a student, I had no money. One of the ways I earned money was to do research, and I did research for a professor, Sheldon Gluck, his name was, who did a book on war crimes. So I read everything in the Harvard Law Library on that subject, and pretty soon I knew more than the professor. And when I got into the Army, the Allies were discovering the atrocities which were being committed on the ground, and they had promised that the Germans would be held to account. And they decided to set up a war crimes branch, and they turned to this professor at Harvard, and he said, "You go find my student Benny over there. He knows all about this." And one day I was tapped on the shoulder. I was by then a corporal in the artillery. And they said, "We're transferring you to General Patton's headquarters." I reported there, and they said, "Your name has been forwarded from Washington. We are directed to set up a war crimes branch. What's a war crime?" And so they had no idea, and I believe I was the first man in the United States Army to deal with war crimes.
Can you explain to us what a war crime is?
A war crime is any violation of the rules of war, which are incorporated into a number of treaties, mostly negotiated with the Red Cross, or common practice among civilized states as well. When we ran into the atrocities being committed in Germany, as well as on German-held territory, the Third Army headquarters, which was General Patton's headquarters, received a report. They would pass it on to me. I would get into my Jeep, rush to the scene of the crime, and begin to collect evidence of the crime. The crimes at that time, at first, they were what we call the Allied flyer cases. Allied flyers, British and American, who were shot down over German-held territory, were almost invariably beaten to death by the mob on the ground. And my job was to get to the scene of the crime as quickly as possible, locate the bodies, find out what had happened, find out, if you can, who was the one who dealt the fatal blow, see that arrest warrants were issued, and then to hold the people for trial. These were the flyer cases. Then we began to run into the concentration camps. And the first reports were that there were some strange-looking people, looked like they were wearing pajamas, coming out of what looked like a work camp. And that came into General Patton's headquarters. They would assign me to look and see what it was. I'd jump into my Jeep, take off for the camp, wherever it was. I would go into the camp as it was being liberated by the Allied forces. The trick was to get in there fast before they destroyed all the evidence. The evidence could be destroyed by the Allied forces themselves coming in and shooting that was going on. The SS was fleeing the camps. The inmates, those who were able to, still chasing them, were mostly lying dead on the ground or dying, piled up like cordwood in front of the crematoria, which were going. That was the scene as I entered the camps, and my first action was to proceed to whoever the tank commander was who had entered the camp first. I would go to him, and I had prepared a pass for myself, asking everybody to cooperate with me fully. I fortunately didn't have to show that pass very often. It was made out with the headquarters of General Patton on the top and signed by some drunken lieutenant, and I had it signed. I'd go to the tank commander, and I'd say, I'm here on orders of General Patton, carrying out a program for the United States. I need 10 men immediately, surround the Schreibstube. The Schreibstube is the office where the documents were kept, the files, and he would say, yes, sir. I would then enter the office, seize whatever documents there were. The Germans were very good document collectors, and I had the names of the people who were killed in the camp. I had the names of the commanders in the camp and other evidence which was vital for conviction later on war crimes.
Was it clear who the prisoners were, and how did you handle seeing it?
It's a very good question. It was not clear to me, and I didn't care anything about the religion or the position of the victims. They were lying on the ground, dead or dying. They were human beings as far as I was concerned. By that time, most of the Jews who were originally required to have a Star of David on their uniform, the uniform were in rags, couldn't identify them in any case. But that was never my direct target. My target was to get the evidence of whoever had been killed there. These were all innocent people. They were prisoners. And I pretended that it was all artificial. It was I managed to put on blinders on my mind and say, this is not real, and go about my business. Of course, it has left a mark on me as well. So I don't like to talk about it. I can't talk about it much, but it was quite a horrible experience and horrible deeds.
In one of the camps, I've read that you actually met a prisoner who had taken tremendous personal risk by burying documents. Can you tell that story?
I remember it very well. I came into the camp, and as usual, I went immediately to the Schreibstube, the office, and there's a clerk there who was one of the prisoners, and he said, I've been waiting for you. And he said, come with me. And he took a shovel, and we went to the electrified fence in the camp, which was not far from the office, and he dug up a box. and he took it back to the office, dusted it off, and then he began to take out of it little cards like a passport. These were ID cards, identification cards, which the inmates used when they joined a club, which they had in the camp. And they would have parties periodically, and then they would get a stamp in this little passport document. And when the document was full, they got a new document, and he was supposed to destroy the old ones. Instead of destroying them, he saved them. Now, every time he did that, he took his life into his own hands, because they would have killed him on the spot, no doubt in my mind whatsoever. But he saved them, hoping that there would one day be a day of reckoning, and I was it.
You finished that work, and then you went home. But then you returned to Germany. So what happened? How did you go back to the United States and come back to Germany?
The United States decided that it was not enough to have the one big international military tribunal trial against Hermann Göring and all the top Nazi leaders, that in order to get a more accurate picture of how Germany could allow such things to be happening in a so-called civilized country, we would have to take a look at the industrialists who built concentration camps in order to have cheap labor or free labor, to see why the lawyers and judges perverted their profession by trying people for persecuting them on all kinds of religious grounds or non-religious grounds, to talk to the doctors who perform medical experiments, to take the whole panorama of German life to get a more accurate picture. And the Pentagon had decided to do that on their own. The other countries were not so interested in that, and they needed help. The war was over, and I came home looking for a job. I had been a sergeant of infantry, and the Pentagon sent me a cable, "Dear sir," they'd never called me sir before, and I went to Washington at their request. So I called up my fiancée, we didn't have such fancy titles then, but the girl from Romania, also from where I came from, Hungary, Romania, Transylvania, I called her up and I said, "How would you like to go to Europe for a brief honeymoon?" She said, "I'd love it." I said, "You got it." And I took the job, intending it to be nothing more than a brief honeymoon. Well, it didn't quite work out that way, but I was hired to go back to help with these subsequent proceedings, as they called it. And the man in charge of that was then Colonel, later General Telford Taylor. We became law partners in New York years later. And I went back with him. And he said, "Ben, look, you're an expert on, you know, researching, getting the evidence of the crimes. We have suspects under arrest, but if you don't have evidence, you've got nothing. So we've got to get the evidence to match the suspects, and we want you to do that." So I put together a crew of about 50 people, went to Berlin, and began going through all the German archives for evidence of criminal activity. And one day, one of my researchers came in and said, "Look what I have." And he gave me a loose leaf binder. It was a listing of how many people had been killed by different units called Einsatzgruppen. Einsatz means action, Gruppen is group, but its name was intended to conceal what their job was. Their job was specifically given to them, and I had the minutes of that as well, to go out and kill without pity or remorse every single Jewish man, woman, and child they could catch. And these reports, I sat down and began to add them up on a little hand machine. When I reached over a million killed, I said, "That's enough." I took a sampling. I flew down to Nuremberg from Berlin, where they were, and showed them to Taylor. And I said, "We've got to put on a new trial." He said, "We can't. The Pentagon has already approved the existing budget. All the lawyers we have been assigned. We don't have staff. We don't have funds. We can't put on a new trial now." And I said, "You cannot let these mass murderers go free." And I was quite adamant in my statement. And he said, "Can you do it in addition to your other duties?" And I said, "Sure." So he said, "Okay, you're it." And so I became the chief prosecutor in what turned out to be the biggest murder trial in human history. First of all, I selected only those who were high rank. I had six or so generals and the best educated men. All, many of them had doctor degrees. One of them had doctor degree. He did the Baba Yaga job, killed 33,771 Jews in 2 days.
Tell me what it felt like to walk into that courtroom.
I was appointed the chief prosecutor. I had three assistants because we had four different units of the Einsatzgruppen A, B, C, and D, and I assigned them for the others. And these were cast-offs from other trials. They didn't want the lawyers. And we were outnumbered 10 to 1 because every defendant, we had 22 of them, was entitled to have two defense lawyers of his own choice, sometimes a few Americans too. So I had 44 defense lawyers against four lawyers, of whom two or three of them weren't worth a darn. They'd been cast off from the other trials. And I felt very confident in my capacity to convict them because the evidence was so overwhelming, even though it was so incredible. I had interrogators who talked to all the defendants under instructions from me. I said, I want to know everything they ever thought or ever did. Give me a complete report on them.
How did you gather the evidence, and did you cross-examine them, or how did it happen?
The evidence was collected by researchers, former German refugees mostly, who went into all the still existing buildings left standing in Berlin, where there might still be documents, the foreign ministry, the SS, the Gestapo, and so on, with instructions. We are aiming for the following defendants, potential defendants or suspects, who are now in the Nuremberg jail, and see whatever we can find. And they would do that. And when they found something, they brought it into me. I checked it out. We sent that down to Nuremberg from Berlin. And since we had here the reports of the Einsatzgruppen giving the names of the unit, the place, the time, the number of Jews they had killed, the number of others they had killed, I said, that's enough for me. That proves the case. So it was relatively simple.
When you stood up on that podium and you made your opening statement, what did it feel like to be surrounded by the magistrates, the defendants, the room itself? What did it feel like to stand at that podium?
I had written the opening statement before I got into the courtroom, of course. I had written it on a Sunday morning, sitting there by myself. And I had cleared it with Telford Taylor, who was my boss. He only changed one word. I felt very confident. I was very serious. I was not nervous. The defendants, they may have been nervous. They should have been. I delivered my opening statement as I intended to. I realized that it probably was the biggest murder trial in human history, and it was. And that was it. I was really a tough bird.
What did it feel like coming from a Jewish family and doing this?
I would say my Jewishness did not really play a role. I had originally, my father was Orthodox, but I was rather skeptical about religion. And it played no role, I would say, in my investigation or the selection of defendants.
So you found around 3,000 people, but you select 22. Tell me why you went with the defendants you went with. Why 22? And why the highest ranking, the most educated?
Well, it's quite ridiculous to say why 22. The answer was because we had only 22 seats in the dock for the trial against Goering and company. The excuse is you couldn't try 3,000 people. I'd still be sitting in Nuremberg trying cases. Nevertheless, just we took a sampling. It was not an attempt to really do justice. I said, where in the scale of justice does that, how do you balance 1 million people murdered against 22 defendants? And why I dealt with that, I said, I must make this trial be of significance to a much broader group. And I asked the court, I pointed out that the people who were executed were killed, murdered, because they didn't share the race and the religion or the ideology of their executioners. And if we could condemn that as a crime against humanity, then it would protect all people in future from being killed for such ridiculous reasons. And so I asked the court to affirm by international criminal law the right of all people, all humans, to live in peace and human dignity regardless of their race or creed or color, and That became with me the primary goal of that trial, and I succeeded in that. The court did condemn crimes against humanity and the actions which had taken place, and although they sentenced, 13 of the defendants to death, in fact, only 4 were executed, and then there was an amnesty for political reasons largely, and the rest of them, a few years, went free. But I felt that if I had managed to push the rock up the hill a bit on crimes against humanity, it would have been worthwhile, and I still feel it was worthwhile.
You went and you talked to some of them afterwards, like Otto Ohlendorf. Did any of them express remorse after the trial?
No one ever expressed remorse. No one ever came up to me and said, I'm sorry. And Ohlendorf is particularly interesting because he was the lead defendant. He was a general in the SS. Nice-looking man, father of 5 children, and he had a very interesting defense. The defense, he said, was we had to ask him, why did you invade, France and Poland and Hungary and Romania and so on? He said it was in self-defense. I said, where is your self-defense? Nobody attacked Germany. He said, yes, but we know they planned to attack. Hitler told us they were planning to attack. He had more information than I had, so I, as a patriotic, loyal German, believed him. And therefore, I did what I had to do in self-defense of my country, which was about to be invaded by the Russians. And he made it clear that he would do it again, even if his own sister were one of those being killed. He said so. And what got to be very interesting to me, he was the only defendant I talked to. I never talked to any of the defendants, Unterfür Augen, as they say, eye to eye. But he seemed to be honest, and I thought, well, he's going to hang for sure. And I went down to the death house, which is right underneath the courtroom in Nuremberg, still there, and I talked to him. And I asked him, is there anything I can do for you, Mr. Ohlendorf? And what I had in mind was, he would say, well, I'm sorry about all this. Please tell my wife I love her. Tell my kids I regret that I did this, blah. Instead, he started to repeat the arguments. It was self-defense. We had to do it and so on. I just slammed the door shut, and there was a window we were speaking through, and walked away.
When the verdict comes down and all of the defendants are declared guilty, did you feel celebratory?
Oh, no, not at all. It was a very solemn atmosphere. Everything was, you could hear a pin drop. There was no cheering, there was no applause, there was nothing. So it was a very grim experience, is I think the best word for it.
You ended up staying in Germany for a decade after this. Tell us just for a moment what you did during that decade. And I think all 4 of your children were born in Germany. You came for a short period of time, but you ended up staying on and on.
Yes, much to my own surprise, because there were various phases in my life. First, the military, but after that was the problem of what do you do about the criminals? After that, what do you do for the victims? Here are the people who've lost everything. And I approached that problem by, first, there was a military government law saying property which had been taken away from the Jews and other victims of Nazis was to be returned to them. And I was appointed by military government law at that time to be the director general. I gave myself the title and the rank to impress the Germans, to recover the heirless and unclaimed Jewish property which had been taken under duress from all the Jewish citizens. And around 1951, German Chancellor Adenauer, who was a very fine, devout Catholic, made a speech in which he said, terrible crimes have been committed in the name of the German people, and it imposes upon us an obligation to try to make amends. And with that, the leading Jewish organization said, okay, he's reaching out. How do we do this? Let us have a conference with them. I had already been working in Germany, so I was counsel to the group. And we began to sit down and try to negotiate the terms of some kind of a reparations agreement. Never had happened in history before that a defeated nation paid individual compensation to any of their victims.
Ben, I want to ask you about the International Criminal Court, of which you've been a champion for a long time. The current administration, John Bolton in particular, but also the president, are not fans. Is this hard line against the ICC, will it damage the legacy of international cooperation that was begun at Nuremberg?
Well, it's a complete repudiation of rejecting the court. Nuremberg was a one-time thing, and it was a strong believer that even your enemy is entitled to a fair trial. And there are certain crimes which cannot be tolerated, crimes against humanity. Civilization can't survive unless they make it clear that these are offenses against everyone. And the court is trying to do that. And it took many years of very great labor. And I wrote lots of books and hundreds of articles on that subject. No, I don't know, 1,000 speeches. And we finally have the court. And I've been honored, actually, when they finally got to their first case. They invited me to do the closing remarks for the prosecution, which I did. It was interesting in comparison because my first case, I was 27 years old. The second one, I was 95. So it took a while.
Ben, what keeps you motivated? You're 99 years old. How do you keep going? And what do you hope to see from the speeches you give, the work you do? You're in a new documentary that's just airing across the country. What do you hope to see?
I realized very early in life, largely during the war itself, when I saw the crimes being committed, people dying, the horrors of war itself, that war is such a terrible thing that I can't believe that the people are so stupid as to continue it. For example, the current system of among nations, if the two heads of state are unable to agree, they send young people out, like you, to kill other young people like you. Until they get tired of killing each other, then they pause and they rest, each side declares victory, and then they start again. And in that process, they also spend billions of dollars every day, to build more weapons to kill more people, instead of using that money to meet the legitimate complaints of people who are suffering different kinds of loss. We build more weapons to kill more people, do the exact opposite of what we're trying to achieve. That is the current system of all countries, including the United States. How can people be so stupid? Have they not suffered enough already? Do they need more in order to see what common sense should tell them, that peace is better than war? Young people have recognized that. I usually get a standing ovation from young people when I tell that to them, because I have no ulterior motive. I don't want, I'm 99 years old. But my wife is also 99 years old, but now suffering from Alzheimer's, so she's not active. But I feel very strongly about that.
Ben Ferenczi, thank you.
You're very welcome.
That's human rights attorney Ben Ferenczi. His life is featured in the new documentary, Prosecuting Evil, The Extraordinary World of Ben Ferenczi, which is currently being shown at film festivals around the country. First Person is produced by Dan Efron and edited by Rob Sachs. We had additional production help on this episode from Jeff Coat O'Donnell. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I've been your host.